Oh, okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Go ahead. Hello. Welcome. Thank you for coming tonight. So I'm going to be reading some work from my new book, An Elephant's Memory of Blizzards, which is absolutely about an elephant's memory of blizzards, because, you know, elephants remember everything. One thing that might be useful to know about the book is, you know, a lot of the work that I did is based on either photographs that I've taken, photographs of artwork that I've taken, or music videos. So what I do is I look at the images, and then from there, usually some ideas emerge, whether it's colors, positioning of characters or the figures in the images, or if it's like a music video, I sort of capture what's going on. So it gives you an idea of what you'll be hearing, because a lot of my work is very fractured, and it's not very narrative, so you'll understand maybe a little bit better what I'm trying to capture. So I'm going to start actually in the middle of the book, if I can get there. And the first poem is called What the Water Gave Us, and it's based on a Florence and the Machine song. And these are sort of, I don't know, postmodern sonnets. They're 14 lines, but they have no rhyme scheme, no syllabic count, nothing. What the Water Gave Me. Jupiter lays down the law on the waterbed, gripping my hair with 10 fingers. There's water in the waterbed, and I'm all dressed up for winter. We're lawless when we wear furry goggles in bed. We're not water moccasins or penguins, and don't call us megalomaniacs or human pests. We sin every day with God's grace in front of his fat, smiling face. Mercy tramples across the face of God with her flowing mess of red hair, as God tramples across the longitudinal earth that trembles beneath our sneakers. Our pockets have pockets filled with parking lots of water. The seven deadly sins begin at birth. Time moves quick between the two of us, Jupiter says, as we head north on US-1. This is a gift that pelicans can't keep secret. From the machine, a storm of parrots flies out of our mouth in the form of a mushroom cloud, radioactive and full of light. The end of the world begins. So that's the first poem. And this, once again, is based on a photograph of the music video. So I'm watching the music video, and I'm taking a picture of it, and then I'm manipulating the picture in my iPhone just because I have nothing better to do with my time. And this was, of course, during a class. It's fairly recently, maybe 2009, 2010... No, it has to be like 2012, because it's from the newer album, right?
Mm-hmm.
2012. And I did it during class as well, taking the picture while I'm showing the video. Now I got to do something with my my time. Is this okay? Sorry. I got to use this because I made a list of what I was going to read.
Okay.
Just because I usually go off course. This is weird. All right, so I'm going to read the last poem in the book, which is called The Supermoon. And once again, it's based on a photograph that I took, I think it was last year when we had that supermoon.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? Mm-hmm. So I have a bunch of images, and I live near Biscayne Bay, so I walked over to a little park. Same thing, took a photograph, manipulated it in my little phone, and this crazy little thing came out. This is a supermoon, not the sun, nor an imposter. This is my shadow to the left of the landing strip of light. Light travels at the speed of kissing. In lieu of a supermoon, we moon the moon. We mood, too. Where is the moon when I'm in school? The periapsis is the shortest distance between my body from one of the foci of Jupiter's elliptical orbit. Even though he is the apoapsis to my periapsis, we both end in S. I want to lick the photons off the supermoon so that I can dream of fire-breathing dragons again. When I sleep, I'm a dragon. I'm also a queen. He said we should make an offering to the supermoon, and then he hugged me like a football player might after winning the Super Bowl. I love the trajectory of hugs. Before he jumped, he took off his pretty hat. So that's the supermoon. And I really saw my shadow, like, reflected in the bay. Not that means anything, but I just wanted to tell you. Does it?
No.
Do we have winter in Florida? I'm totally going off track here. Yeah, winter. Actually, it's been kind of a cold winter in Florida, no?
Yeah.
It's sort of, you know, my heater broke, so it made it colder. Yeah. My God, I couldn't survive without a heater. I'd turn the oven on and probably like burn the house down. I'm gonna go to the podium somehow.
Let's go.
So, can you hear me okay? Okay, I'm gonna read a longer poem, and this is the first poem in the book, and it comes from a line in an Ann Carson book called The Autobiography of Red. And if any of you've been to my house, all of my walls are like blood red. So my house is in here. This book was in there. I'm reading it in my house, and everything's red, and I'm like, okay, this is insane. So this is what came out of it. A prayer for a blue cloud. We pray for the paste of blue cloud to entangle itself in the red sky of Biscayne Bay. We pray for the wind to sweep away this blue cloud of bitter knots. We pray for the sound of wind, too, and for the discordant sonic vibrations that make the wind blue. We pray for the howling wind, the steady wind, the disquieted and ancient wind, and we pray for the absence of wind. We pray for the electromagnetic spectrum too, especially blue. We pray for the absence of presence and the presence of absence. We pray for the unflickering candle flame and the amber light that flame emits. We pray for the two sides of the moon, the poles too, and every lunar landscape between the two. We pray for the moon to reveal its other side of the wound, so that it may heal its other side of the wound. We pray for the prayers we've made to you, the wind, the moon, and the paste of blue cloud in the red sky. We pray for the red grass, the red snow, and the invisible colors of our universe. We pray for these things inside of our red bedroom. We pray around our red room with our legs crossed like ancient Buddhas. We're tiny humans. Our bodies caked in red mud to remind us of where we come from and where we will go. We pray in silence so that everyone can hear us praying in silence for you. We pray for the progress of edifices. We pray for concentration and mindfulness, loving kindness and wisdom. We pray for the end of dis-ease and restlessness. We pray for aliens, slaves, and sinners. We pray for lava and sage. We pray for the rain of serenity, for thunder and lightning. We pray for the unsaid things in our solemn prayers. And we pray for the tiny giants who will one day face each other and hold hands beneath the burning red sky. During the flood of red flames that will come for us soon. Whenever the blue cloud entangles itself in the red sky, we will continue to pray on our invisible ship, our invisible fortress, for the divine discourse of the soul, for the end of the in-between, and for the windows to open and then unto an unentangled sky of white clouds, free-floating against the insane blue, and embrace each other like mighty humans. So, I need water. This comes from sitting in my house, staring at the red walls, reading this book, and then also, once again, a photograph of a painting of this portrait and profile of a face, and I manipulated the image, so it created I forgot what it's called, but basically it duplicated the image in reverse, so it became two faces facing each other out of just one face. Any questions? Can you hear? Okay. Because usually I'm pretty low. So you want to hear a transgender poem?
Of course.
I don't know if it's appropriate for this location.
Are you sure?
I'm kidding.
I was born a woman.
I was shocked that you were actually a man.
I'm not done with my search.
Make sure they snip everything. Make sure they're...
Christine's on the wall there.
Oh, Lord.
Here?
Where? The second one?
Oh, okay. It's Milton Berle.
Okay. Oh, yeah, same thing.
I got it messed up.
Milton
Berle. People did all the time.
I thought she suffered.
So the book is like sort of three sections. the first section of these sort of like longer, like the poem that I just read, these sort of, I don't know, I call them these sort of like, I don't want to say the word spiritual, but there's like something vibrational in that side. I hate that word and I hate religion. Sorry. but it's something that I dealt with. The middle of the book are these sonnet poems that deal with music videos or photographs that I've taken. The last part of the book deals with this character named Steve, who is this young boy, based on a true story, who was sexually molested, you know, the usual story in school, by the math teacher, et cetera, et cetera. So this section of the book kind of like reimagines Steve in different scenarios in his life, as a young boy, as a young man, and then as sort of a young boy transitioning to a young woman. So they kind of like are these crazy, insane situations. So I'll read you one section from this section of the book, one poem from the section. I'll read the Song of Mass Destruction, which is actually a title that I stole from Annie Lennox. So these are short prose sections. So the Song of Mass Destruction. Steve hates IKEA and counts light bulbs with his fingers, and each guy takes them on. He counts the entire contents of the solar system in his head, Jupiter, Hubble, Kazakhstan. He is not religious, but he says the Hail Mary to pass the time, and just in case he meets her one day, he wants to live again. They will not call it quits, not even when they find out he is a man, because they've already paid for the night, and they'll get what they paid for. He fucking fag is inevitable. It's dark, but he can make out the man who looks like Mr. White. Steve convinces himself it's not that bad. Every quasar is powered by accretion. Scientific consensus. Each man takes his turn. Each one conspires with the other to keep silent, even though it will not keep silent. Each man is a mirror image of the other, a smooth manifold equipped with a closed interior switch. They will laugh in his face and spit when they're done because the joke is on them. Sing, my son, sing, she says. He doesn't say a word. Her face looks like his, but she is fat, and she can't stand the smell of cigarettes, even though she loves truckers. His face will not be recognizable to her, but she will console it with ice and told you so, and wipe away the blood until he closes his eyes and curls up with a shih tzu. It is not 1975. When she comes home from work the next day, she takes off her miniskirt. She never wears underwear because time is money. And when she jumps into bed with her son, he rolls over and wraps his red cape around her. He is not Superman, and she will never have another son. He gets out of bed and waxes his brows. The mortgage is due, and he counts the cash. He counts himself among the living and blesses himself in the name of Jimmy Rogers and the Beehive Cluster. Crosses off Mr. White. It's been a profitable week. So that's a taste of what goes through. And there's a lot of very highly sexualized pieces in this section. Wonder Woman appears, saves the day, and there's like a little test at the end of the book. And this book is actually very serious because my first book was like a little more comedic. I don't know if you can call poetry comedic, but I'm trying to find like the funny poems in here and they don't exist. Sorry. But we have Greg who will make you like pee your pants. So it's like a really good balance. I'll read you one more. So this is called Ganesh, based on a photograph of a 13th century Ganesh sculpture that I saw at the Chicago Art Museum or Art Museum of Chicago.
Art Institute.
And like I always screw it up. Sorry, the Chicago one. Ganesh. Somewhere between the Big Bang and the Big Gulp, the universe lives silent and cunning in her unstable mink suits. Somewhere between the atoms that create us and the atoms that will destroy us, the universe lives benignly unaware of our prayers and promises. Somewhere between the edge of the cosmos and the comic book store, the universe lives in the smile of a boy and our girl standing on the southwest corner of 42nd Street beneath the bearded sky in a blizzard in awe of the universe, wearing white mittens and long johns. Somewhere between the crucible and the last dance, the universe lives in every elementary particle that powers every disco ballroom from heaven to Las Vegas. Somewhere between the heavy elements and the light elements, the universe lives in our desire to be prepositioned for entry through the gates of heaven. Somewhere between heaven and hell, the universe lives free of sin and sorrow. Between Ganesh and Goliath, the universe lives in an elephant's memory of blizzards. Between the belly button and the Achilles heel, the universe lives with a secret that no one, not even God, can remove obstacles that do not exist in the physical world. Between the real universe and the imagined universe, humans live in a constant state of humming, in a constant state of aha and oh no and what the fuck. Between you and me, the universe lives in the well-beings that reside within us, in every obstacle and in every wound, in every chance and in every bedroom, and even in the womb sealed tight from the light of the blue moon. Thank you. Yay.
Greg, it's all yours.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's fine. Let me see. That's working.
Okay.
Why don't you put this on? Put this on the table.
Okay, great.
Aim, hey, y'all.
Aim it towards you. Okay, good. That's fine.
Hi. So I'm going to read some poems from my new chapbook, and then I'm going to read some brand new poems. I've been living in Florida since December, and I don't want to go back to Chicago. And it's been really amazing. I've been very prolific while I've been down here, which makes me very happy. It's a good sign. I'm meant to be here. So the chapbook is called Greg Shapiro 77. And it's actually, the cover is an homage to the album Talking Heads 77. Oh. Complete with the matching back cover. So it's a series of poems about the 1970s, and each poem is represented, each year is represented by a poem. So I'm going to read four of them from this. Each year it's apostrophe and then the last two digits, so it's apostrophe 70, etc. So I'm going to begin with 70. 1970 was the year of my mother's ugly brown Pontiac Catalina sedan. The year my father drove the two-tone green and white Dodge panel van, delivering sugary confections at the Sweet Stuff Candy Company. Neighborhood children, especially those occupying nearly every apartment of the 18-unit Hull Street tenements, waited for his curbside to come home at the end of the day and hand out bubblegum in the shape of pizza, and pizza slices and hot dogs, Butterfinger and Baby Ruth candy bars, Astro Pops, sticky gumdrops, black crows, chalky Necco wafers, oversized jawbreakers, licorice whips, and the crunchy colored candy dots stuck to paper. That year, high school hippies invaded the damp, dark, and maze-like basement of the Courtyard building for a weekend of drugs and sex. No one knew they were there until we found the stash of roaches and rolling papers they left behind, and the psychedelic speed kills and peace sign graffiti scrawled in daigle colors on the cold concrete floors. It was the summer I perfected my Chinese jump rope technique and shoop shoop hula hoop skills, while my contemporaries were doing tricks of frisbee in Tecumseh Park, winning trophies on bowling teams at Oakland Bowl and in the Little League at Dillon Stadium. I rode a used blue 5-speed Schwinn Stingray with a white, sparkly white banana seat and learned how to change flat bicycle tires on an almost daily basis. With my allowance, I bought records at Ben Franklin, Turnstile, and E.J. Corvette. For hours, I listened to It Ain't Easy by Three Dog Night, Deja Vu by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and Portrait by The Fifth Dimension, and 45 by Bobby Martin, Vanity Fair, Melanie, The Marmalade, The Brotherhood of Man, and The Sandpipers. That was the year, long before parental advisory stickers, that my parents bought me the gatefold 3-record set Woodstock soundtrack that I asked for my birthday. I played all six sides repeatedly until the day my mother appeared in the doorway of my bedroom, mouth agape, pale as the dish towel on which she was wiping the wet hands, as Country Joe McDonald, the fish cheer, roared, "Give me an F, give me a U, give me a C," out of the speakers of my phonograph, as I sat before it awash in all the childlike wonder and amazement I could muster. So now we're going to skip ahead a few years to 1975. And so this is called 75. My father wanted to beat the bicentennial rush, motivated less by patriotism than the desire for a head start on families just like ours, piling into oversized station wagons, assorted land yachts, to drive across country, take in sights and sounds of American history. Bound for glory, old and new, in a late model, two-door, black Ford LCD with a vinyl Landau roof and red pillow-top crushed velour interior that heated up quickly in the summer vacation sun. My parents ordered triptychs from AAA, and as soon as they were delivered, we paged through them, following the highlighted route with our fingers. We packed this car's studio apartment-sized trunk with a couple weeks' worth of luggage, books, games, and snacks. My mother and father alternated shifts behind the wheel, while my brother and sister and I teased each other relentlessly about the sounds and smells emanating from our bodies within the car and those that seeped in from outside. Despite countless stops to fill the thirsty gas tank and empty our bladders, we arrived in Philadelphia, prepared to absorb copious amounts of useful information and experiences and in dire need of motionless sleep. The high-rise Holiday Inn had a rooftop pool, and we swam in it under a starry night sky after a day-long walking tour that incorporated the Liberty House, Independence Hall, Betsy Ross's house, Elfrith's Alley, where my father surreptitiously pocketed a loose brick as a souvenir, and the Perlman Antique Toy Museum. When we couldn't store another historical fact, we filed into an air-conditioned movie theater to watch Robert Altman's Nashville. Hotel rooms were scarce near Washington, D.C. the year before the bicentennial, so we checked into a motel in Cheverly, Maryland, and made the daily drive down 295 to the nation's capital, where we visited the White House and the National Zoo, the Lincoln and Jefferson Memorial, Washington Monument, and the Watergate of 1975, after all. There was a day trip to Mount Vernon, one of a handful of dog-eared photos remaining from that family vacation. There was also an awkward dinner at dimly lit Mr. Henry in Georgetown, tense and sprinkled with a post-meal anti-gay epithet directed at the flirtatious waiter, the significance of which wouldn't reveal itself until I made a return trip there as an out-gay man 10 years later. And who could blame us kids for being almost as excited at the prospect of visiting Hershey, Pennsylvania on the way home to Chicago, a sweet reward for a minimum of bruises and bloodshed in the back seat for what turned out to be a dress rehearsal for the following summer's road trip to the West Coast. And this is a title poem from the book. 77. Was this our Paris in the 20s? Sneaking into the girls' bathroom on the 8th floor of 600 South to study, transcribe, and transform the graffiti on the stall walls into poetry. Escorted by punk rock girl poets called Electro Muck and Sharon Cheralike. When Maxine caught us, she only shook her head. We had hair that could be colored, crimped, teased, 10x'd into submission from impromptu fashion shows in bars so dark and dirty, dreary and decaying, that tetanus clouded the air. Bodies slammed as means of dancing, greeting, and displaying affection, guitar was taught to us as we chanted or screamed along because we knew all the words. When people stared, as we dared them to do, we set aside boredom for artistic expression, baptizing them in confrontation. Posed like rabid mannequins under streetlights, safety pins, pale skin, zippers, and razor blades flashing like little atomic bombs. 78. This was back when Boys Town was still called New Town. When fierce drag queens held court in the window at the Golden Nugget at the corner of Belmont and Broadway, shouting night parties. And when there were no knives, they bust coffee cups on the table and wheels of broken ceramic shards like blades. Before Donna Summer went Jesus crazy, and only the gays dancing until near collapse as Crystal Blinkers and the Broadway Limited knew about her, too generous to keep her a secret. The village people were still macho men and hadn't checked into the YMCA yet. We were college students with hungers new and familiar. For food, before the clubs, Joel catered to our needs from his post at the host stand at the brewery, making sure we had enough nourishment from the abundant and fern-hung salad bar. After the disco, we dined at the Medina, now a Gap, in the wee smallest hours of the morning. When we kissed each other like friends and went our separate ways, we never asked about what happened after sunrise. When we kissed like lovers in the rambling apartment on Sheffield, doors slammed and windows rattled, but we nestled in each other's arms, eager to learn what we could teach each other, anxious for homework that was meant to be done naked between the sheets. So these are four new poems. And in this first poem, I use the word Fagala, which is a sort of a derogatory word for some gay. So this is called The Indignity. Try not to live to 100 unless you have invested wisely, come from a family whose name rhymes with Rockefeller or Nassus or Vanderbilt, or has socked away every red cent you have ever earned. Otherwise, you will find yourself at the mercy of three daughters who married for love, not money, who will attempt to mother you, to smother you, to this, that, and the other you, mistaking protection for affection, trepidation for asphyxiation. The list of indignities you will suffer is cyclical, like the Torah. When you think you have reached the end, you roll up the scroll and begin again. Modern plays take the lead from their biblical forebears. Loss of bladder control and relentless flow of urine symbolizes water. Undisciplined great-grandchildren leap like frogs across various pieces of furniture. Bedbugs, the kissing cousins of life, take residence in the sofa bed where your caregiver sleeps. You swipe at her curses, spat at you in an unfamiliar tongue like pesky flies. The meat you love from the costly kosher butcher tastes diseased. Teeth and skin conspire to incurably alter your once handsome appearance. Hail and thunder, which never stopped you from going anywhere before, keeps you indoors, lulled by and beholden and fastened to the television. A former welterweight and contemporary of body losses, you are itching to watch a boxing match, but reality show housewives crawling all over the TV screen like locusts are the only ones fighting with each other. Why is it at night, when darkness fills your stifling room, you are plagued with insomnia? Is it because you let your firstborn grandson, the Fagala, live to write poems about you? This is called Dedicated Driver. And this is after Denise's demo. At the Aventura Mall, wandering the luminous and cacophonous corridors, window shopping at Louis Vuitton, the Apple Store, and Y3 by Yoji Yamamoto, eyeing the delicacies at the food court, a $10 milkshake at Haagen-Dazs, clutching a personally inspired copy of your friend's new book of poems, catching up on past and present health crises, watching a zombie rom-com, you don't think anything could possibly dampen your mood. Not even the momentary panic of not being able to find your cars in the labyrinthine parking structure. But you've been wrong before. The text letting you know that you're expected to make an appearance at Tropics, where those waiting for you have already been situated for a couple of gin-soaked hours, causes you to miss your exit at sunrise. You're getting better at navigating 95, and the Oakland Park off-ramp comes up quickly. A metered parking space in front of the bar is taken as a good sign, although that could go either way, too. Once inside, you take stock of the looming potential disaster. Your husband ensconced at the piano bar singing show tunes. Your sister-in-law, Debbie, and niece, Monica, faces flushed, garbled speech and wild hair are the picture of plastered delight. Novices to gay bar culture, they've made fast friends with the equally pickled patrons and overly accommodating waitstaff. But Debbie's had enough of the showy belters and wants to go country line dance. Weaving unsteadily out onto the sidewalk where their carriage and driver awaits, it's less than 5 minutes to the next Ritzy Bar. At the aptly named Scandal, with your trio of passengers who have ordered another trio of drinks, you run into people you know visiting from Chicago. After introductions are made, first you are credited with being the desiccated driver, then the dedicated driver. When you correct the slurs, getting your proper due as the designated driver, you soberly think to yourself, this is why I don't drink, why I never drink. But this is before the twirled and twisted two-step become the two-person pile-up on the dance floor, before the broken glass and spilled cocktail, the raised voices and disoriented disagreement at the poker table, before you slip quietly out after making sure they have cab fare, before the phone rings and they ask you if you've taken off your hat for the night, before you pick them up just north of the 6th Avenue Bridge and return them safely and soundly home. Peas for breakfast. Try as I might, I can't remember how I felt about vegetables as a child. I do recall they were rarely fresh or frozen, mostly canned, mostly served room temperature. My mother, like her mother before her, knew enough about nutrition and health to insist that we clean our plates, eat every last colorful slice of carrot, golden kernel of corn, stalk of asparagus, dark leaf of spinach, stretch or curve of bean. I don't think I filled my cheeks with half-chewed greens, legumes, or stalks the way I did with rubbery chicken, fatty or stringy beef, or tough, greasy lamb, waiting to be excused from the table to run inconspicuously to the bathroom to empty my mouth. It's a wonder I could answer any questions about the day at school or homework, my tongue fighting to tuck the meat between teeth and jowl. Did I really think that I was fooling my parents, anyone else at the table? Years later, no longer living under their roof, we laughed, joked about it, but at the time, it was a high crime, punishable by dish and silverware rattling fists, pounding on tabletops, threats to life and limbs. This morning, in a sunny kitchen, more than 1,000 miles to the southeast, I poured half a bag of frozen petite green beans into a pale green bowl, heated them up in the microwave. That may sound nutritious, but the peas, some smooth and perfectly round, others wrinkled and uneven, were swimming in salted butter. As if that wasn't enough, I lightly sprinkled kosher salt over the steaming, verdant, edible landscape. Some habits are harder to break than others. Sometimes progress moves slower than the time it takes to heat up the rest of the bag of frozen peas for breakfast. Thank you so much for being such a great audience. This is the last poem. I really appreciate this. And thanks to Stonewall and to Nate for all this. And my co-reader, Neil, what a pleasure. And this is called How to Flirt. Listen to Doris Day singing, "Once I had a secret love," no more than 214 times a day, or an amount equal to your heartbeat on an especially loathsome or love-stoked Valentine's Day when you were 9 or 19 years old. Avoid singing or humming, "Que sera, sera," like a cheating act. Otherwise, whatever will be, won't be. Bat your eyes, or try not to think about baseball bats, Christian Bale as Batman, vampire bats, or batty old ladies like Aunt Clara on Bewitched. Be bewitching without twitching or casting an irreversible spell. Spell it out in letters big enough to read from a great distance. Keep your distance from boxes of chocolates, bouquets of flowers, anything associated with allergies and fevers of the flesh. Flesh out as much as you can about his past, your past lives lived among roaming tribes, romantic royalty, plundering pirates, or tricky tricks. Obsess over his handsome profile on social media sites you wouldn't ordinarily frequent without an experienced guide, instruction manual, or some form of protection. Frequently check your breath, your pulse, your email and phone, your hair, and anything reflective, with the exception of his mirrored sunglasses. Dress for sex, for success, to impress. Don't forget to wear clean underwear. Remember what your mother told you about reckless drivers and crosswalks. Cross with the light, cross your heart, and hope to die of embarrassment if he ever sees you crossing your heart. Hide the doodles, the scrawled hearts on binders and spiral notebook covers containing the swirly equation of your initials in a place so secret that even you have trouble remembering where it is. Cover your ass. Remember, he doesn't even know you're alive.
Does anybody have any questions of either Neil or Greg about how they published, how they got started, all that other fun stuff?
Do either of you have books for sale?
That would be my second question.
Do you want to put it up there?
Yeah.
Let me get four.
So how did you guys get started?
Prostitution?
That's a good segue.
Started with what?
Writing in the book.
I remember in high school I had this crazy friend who we're still friends with today. She was an artist and I was a writer. She would sit across the room and she would draw these guys with these enormous dicks and she'd hold them up so like I could see it but the teacher couldn't see it, and then I'd be like, ugh, and then I'd start writing. So I started in high school writing these sort of pornographic poems.
Yes. Did you ever publish that book?
No. I think I still have some of the poems in my garage.
You can make a movie out of it.
I think there's already been a movie made about that.
How did you get started?
I always wrote, and then when I started college, I started actually as a theater major, which was a bad idea, and. And then I realized I actually like writing better than theater. So I focused on that, and then I quit college for a little while, and then went back, and then shifted my major to writing. So I started college in Chicago, but graduated from Emerson College in Boston.
Neil, you seem to have used a lot of scientific terminology in your work. In three of your pieces, I believe, you mentioned Jupiter, which I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Significance to that?
Yes.
Share.
Pollo Tropical, sitting with my ex, telling this story, and basically the story ended with someone saying to him, "You're like Jupiter. You're like so far away." And the lovely thing about Jupiter is it's this giant red storm that's always circling. So. That's part of the answer. So Jupiter exists in like like four or five of the poems throughout the book. And it's just, I don't know, it's a nice word.
Yeah. It's just a nice word. Do you have a science background?
No, but I do. I bought it because I don't have it in my house. Well, for many years, I would read a lot of scientific books. Like, I had no idea what the hell I was reading, like quantum theory and string theory and like all these things. For some reason, I was obsessed with it. But I bought this book by Roger Penrose, which has all of the mathematical equations of the universe. It's just a giant blue book, like this thick. And a lot of the pieces sort of like came from there. I would open the book, go through the book, and you find these really beautiful passages, these sort of mathematical equations, but not only that, like the explanation of what they mean. And I would steal words from there and play around. So yeah, it comes from there. I think it's a beautiful language.
Just wondering if you Einstein's theory of relativity
or something. Yeah, I mean, I've used it before because actually I have a copy of it somewhere, and I think I probably avoided using that because it's like so popular anyway. Forget Einstein. It's like kindergarten stuff.
Yeah. He couldn't even comb his hair. I'm just jealous because I don't have any hair.
You could get a wig. You get like an Einstein. And I think. Anything else?
The question is for Greg. I noticed that, well, the scrapbook, right, it's 77, and a lot of the poems sort of have this, like, Americana feel to them, and it reminded me so much of bands like The Whole City, and I'm wondering, do other artists, musicians inspire some of your poetry?
Well, this is definitely a very musical book, because it was when I was, you know, I was a kid, sort of, you know, like that sort of kid into teen transition period. And so that was when I was, and I always loved music as a kid. I think I bought my first record was, the first 45 I ever bought was I Wanna Hold Your Hand by the Beatles. It was my own money the first time, and I was like so excited. And so music has always been really important, and so when putting this book together, the whole idea of keeping, making it look like the record and the whole thing was very, very important. So yeah, music definitely plays a big part. But I haven't, which I think is really interesting, what you do is, I mean, music figures very heavily into your work as well, but you combine the audio and the visual aspects, which I think is a really interesting idea. Because you always hear people writing about one or the other. People are writing about, like, a painting or something, or about a song. Mm-hmm. But to combine those two and then to write about them, I think, is really interesting. I haven't done that yet. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. All right.
This is your
first or second book? This is my second book. The book that came out in 2008, a full-length collection called Protection. And I just finished a new chapbook that I just sent off this morning to Midsummer Night's Press, which is a press in New York. They do these really tiny little beautiful books. And so I just sent, I mean, I have no idea if he's going to take it, but I just sent it off.
I thought your first book is 100% totally different than that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like two different people. So could you give us kind of an overview of what made that book unique?
Yeah, definitely. The first book was split into three sections. It was very geographical, although this is also geographical in a way, but it's got a Chicago section, a Boston section, and a Washington, D.C. section, also using where they lived. But they were poems that were written over a really long period, like probably, I'm going to guess, more than 20 years. So it represents a lot of different voices. This book, on the other hand, has one older poem in it, but the rest of them were all written within a 1.5 to 2 year period. It started because there's a literary magazine called Court Green, and they do a section within the magazine called the Dossier, where they do like a themed section in the magazine. And the theme for that particular issue was the 1970s. So I wrote the first poem for that, and I sent it to them, and they promptly rejected it. But I thought it sort of opened the floodgates, and I thought, shit, I lived through the 70s. I may as well write about it. You know, I mean, and I mean, I was a kid in the 70s, but you know, you always hear about the 70s. So that's sort of why it's so different, because it's really a much more compact time in which I was writing.
If you go for your second book, if you find it more challenging, or put together a second book, or did it come with more ease? Or how was that experience in writing that second book?
Well, it was weird because I have all these other poems going, what about me? Wait a second. Because I've probably got like three more book length collections ready to go that have not, that are not at all related to this. This was just really fast. So it was kind of a weird thing, and I felt like I was being a neglectful mother. Big surprise. That's why I don't have kids. And so I felt like I focused on this because I wanted to get this one out, but I'm already ready to like the next full length one. So.
Well, my first book was my thesis for the MFA program, so I had like a dedicated space to do that. excuse me. For this book, it was unconsciously written. And that's why it's sort of like divided into three sections, because they all sort of emerged in different worlds, different times. And to be honest with you, I was sort of frustrated last summer, and I went to see Maureen in New Mexico, another poet friend of mine who we have collaborative books together. And I was probably whining, and she's like, just put everything you have into one file and let me look at it. So I did that, and I know it's just bullshit. She's like, oh, this is a book. You know, send it out to the publisher. I think she just made that up. I don't think she even read it. It's basically just the act of doing it. Because I have just a lot of stuff that I just do and I create, and it's just all spread out all over the place. Because I don't really write with like a purpose. That sounds ridiculous. But because then if I have a purpose, I start to get nervous and stop producing. So I have to do it accidentally.
But doesn't it help them to have another set of eyes look at something?
Yeah, for sure.
And see something that you never even saw
was
there.
Sure. No, I'm just kidding. She helped a lot. She's like... But sometimes I'm thinking, I think she just didn't read the book. But I guess this one was no pressure. Because the MFA program is pressure, because you have to produce the thesis, basically, to graduate. So that was like stress. This was more just casual. It was fun and just came together. And that was that.
There seems to be a big juxtaposition between the pieces you get tonight, that between an internal search versus an external and familiar and warm-hearted sort of memory-driven stuff. It seems like a big difference in terms of your writing. Is that true? You find your earlier pieces and your earlier pieces similar in each of those kind of categories?
referring to my
stuff? Your stuff seems to be more internal and more, I don't know, even like mystical in some of them. Some of your, what I heard tonight, and yours, I think, I remember my childhood figures, you know, in the 70s and all that stuff.
I'm very shallow and vapid, and all I have is my... That's it. I don't have that kind of... I'm not deep searching. I sort of just am what I am, and it's, you know, I don't know if I'm saying that, but I feel like, for me, that by sharing my experience, and some of it's real, some of it's not real, and good luck to figure out what is and what isn't. But by doing that, someone can have a, you know, one of those Oprah aha moments. And you can say, I had something similar. I like that. I like when I look around and I see someone recognizes a band or a song or a movie or something, and they get it. So, but when you write about the 70s, those people are few and far between. And I said to start doing readings in nursing homes now. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, okay. This book is, I think, radically different from my first book. And like the first part of the book are these sort of very heavy, like, and I hate the word like spiritual, but mystical. And it's really, they really come from this Camus quote, through an odd reasoning starting out from the absurd of the ruins of reason in a closed universe, limited to the human, they deify what crushes them and find reason to hope
and what impoverishes them. That forced hope is religious in all of them. It deserves attention. So I was trying to sort of pay attention to this hope that we all seem to have, even when it's worthless, useless, and dangerous. So like the first section of the book kind of tries to address that in different ways. I've always been sort of very anti-religious and anti-spiritual. And I sort of had a relationship with someone who was the opposite of me. Mm-hmm. Like chanting to every crystal, ghost, light, bulb, whatever, in the home. So it was this weird crash of things, and it made me sort of reevaluate that world. So I don't know. And I'm happy we're done with it.
Mm-hmm. Were you raised in a religious home?
I mean, I went to Catholic school, but we're not very religious. But if I say bad stuff about Jesus, my mom's like, you're going to go to hell. Give me a break.
This is something related to what you were asking, which is this idea that I constantly try to, and I'm constantly in this dilemma to with writing, which is I hear this very cliche advice, write about what you know, but then recently I've been getting involved with Twitter, and you hear a lot of different opinions about poetry. One of the things that really struck me was that one of the poets said that you write to make sure that someone else, the reader, recognizes himself in the poetry, almost like a Wordsworth type of mirror to the reader. And I don't know, I think that in terms of your muse, if you have a muse, a particular muse, does it change from poem to poem? I mean, you constantly have a reader in mind when you write?
Me. Me. I mean, I can't escape myself. I mean, I have this horrible memory that I can't get rid of. That's it. I mean, I could pretend. I do pretend. I do pretend and create other stuff. But I can read some stuff that is complete fiction, and I find me in there in every line. You know, it's just, you just have to sort of look for it. So, I mean, I think there's a difference between, like, writing what you know and being, like self-indulgent, which I think is kind of what you're maybe circling around. So, I don't know.
I guess it's self-indulgent is, you know...
I don't worry about it.
No, I guess...
Don't worry about it. I mean, if you start trying to think and figure out, like, who's going to want to read what... And what do I want now? I mean, it's worthless. Just do what you want to do.
Yeah. But because the poetry audience is really small to begin with, and so you'll always have other poets to read to. I mean, that's sort of what it is. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, how many people in this room are other poets in this room? You do? Okay, so... You know, that's what happens. That's what your audience is. But boy, are we grateful to do a reading when it's not a reasonable poet, too. It's great to see people. Anybody here, is this their first poetry reading? Anybody's first poetry reading? Okay, there you go. So that makes it every bit rewarding, too. Because, and I hope that you'll come
the
back to
scare
more
them
poetry.
Off.
Right. You don't scare away, you'll come back to more, because that's, you know, I mean, Florida is really lucky right now because Florida's rock star, the rock star of poetry right now is Richard Blanco.
Oh, Blanco.
But,
mm-hmm.
I mean, no, but he's from Maine.
Becomes
but
your
I mean,
first material.
Right. But he grew up here, he was educated
he's
here.
He's this month, he's coming this month.
Right.
Your
so
last
it's really month. Exciting to see that. I mean, it's
yeah.
like,
yeah.
I mean, his book is probably selling better than any book of poetry has sold in a long, long time.
Right. And a lot of Miamians came out to see him at the reading, which was shocking for me.
We had, yeah. He's been with Stonewall twice. First time was when he first wrote his first book, and he never read. This was the first time. The first audience he had was here at Stonewall, non-students and non-family members. But he writes about his family, and it's hilarious.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
He ever, City of Fire? Was it City of Fire?
City of
100 Fires. Got if you that's Miami. That's his vision of Miami. And he just writes about his family and his grandmother.
His grandmother poem, yeah.
His grandmother poem, fabulous. But what he read on the day of the inauguration is like nothing like.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, all this stuff is hilarious. It's probably you want to start laughing. It's back in print. It's been out. It was out of print for a long time. The City of 100 Fires. If you want to give a great gift, University of Pittsburgh Press. I just spoke with him.
I imagine you could check it out from the library.
And you really got all six.
Do you work here? Yeah.
You know, his pictures up on the wall. He's one of our little. I do have a question. A really simple one. I've asked this of a lot. All the gay poets that have come to visit us.
Okay.
I did it again. I'm not. And that is you know, the minority group, the African American community is in a huge, huge surgence or resurgence of poetry with rap. You know, that their vision, their expression, it's just, you know, been coming out like crazy for the last probably 8 or 10 years. It could be longer. We don't know.
30 years.
Well, okay, long time. Why hasn't the burning fire of discrimination and being a second class citizen hit the gay world? Why don't we have gay rap? Well, gay angry rap.
Well, we have performance poetry, which, from my perspective, those are two words going in the same sentence. But that's where queer poets are really being hurt in that venue. It's because, you know, it becomes a little theatrical. It's got that little gay angle to it. But it really is a place, when I think about, you know, Stacey Ann Chin or Reggie Cavico, it's just, that's where it's happening. That's from my perspective, that's what's happening.
I just want a gay rap star.
We do have gay rap stars, but they rap about sex.
They rap about
Caswell.
Right, but I want the political, you know, stuff. But no, I'm Roy.
Wow.
Roy.
Stuff, right?
And we will decorate you with all that.
I will
get
you
off.
Actually, something
cockering.
I get you look giant.
Yeah.
Felt boa.
I was asking this to my students when I talked with, like,
why
there was a famous. We were just talking because, you know, we're talking about this idea of minority, right, and minority writing, and not even minority per se, but just the idea of challenging the status quo, challenging institutions. And one of the poets we were actually reading was a female poet, and a lot of students. It was Anne Sexton, and students still felt uncomfortable talking about menstruation in poetry, and that's something that,
really?
Yeah, and I was just kind of pushing boundaries a little bit, like, you know, what about talking about gay issues, and still a lot of people feel uncomfortable even talking about the female body, so I think that this idea of rapping, I mean, now we're having more female rappers come to the spotlight, but...
No, I think it is the performance poetry scene that's happening. But even predating the performance poetry scene, there was the dial poem poet, Laurie Anderson was involved, William F. Burroughs, I can't think of the guy, John Giorno. John Giorno's poetry scene. Do you ever find those? And they even have them here. Recordings from the 70s and 80s that were unbelievable. And Giorno was really pissed off. So it's there. And Ginsberg was involved with them. And that predates rap. That predates all that stuff. And it was pretty amazing stuff. They were combining a little bit of like rhythmic stuff, a little music in the background. But that's where it was back then.
Maybe. Thank you.
Good night. I want you to know that it must be really bad TV tonight because 65